Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to Ancient Wisdom Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond, right here on UK Health Radio. It is so lovely to have you with me again, and a big thank you to so many of you who reached out after last week's episode exploring human connection and loneliness. It clearly resonated. I have loved hearing your stories, from starting new hobbies and joining local groups to knocking on neighbours' doors, volunteering and offering support in your communities. There seems to be a real thread of people stepping back into connection in simple human ways. And I've had quite a few messages about gardening too, which I absolutely love, not just for the connection it brings, but for everything else that comes with it. Movement, time outdoors, a sense of purpose, it all adds up. And interestingly, that leads us beautifully into today's conversation, because alongside how we connect with others, there's also the question of how we connect with ourselves. Since the last episode, I've had some really interesting conversations, both in clinic and out in the community, where a common theme keeps coming up. Not just how people are feeling, but what they're doing with those feelings. Because for many of us, life moves quickly. We push things down, we carry on, we stay busy. And we often don't realise quite how much we're holding until the body starts to speak a little louder. And that's exactly what we're exploring today. In Chinese medicine, emotions aren't seen as separate from physical health. They're considered one of the internal causes of disease. There's a concept known as the seven emotions: anger, joy, worry, grief, fear, shock, and pensiveness, each with the potential, when held or prolonged, to influence the body in different ways. What's fascinating is that modern research is now beginning to reflect this, from stress physiology and inflammation to the impact of immune function and long-term health. We're starting to understand more about what happens when emotions aren't fully processed. So today, we're asking, what's the difference between feeling an emotion and holding on to it? What actually happens in the body when we suppress how we feel? And how do we begin to process and move through emotion in a way that supports, not disrupts, our health? To explore this, I'm joined by someone whose work has been deeply rooted in this understanding for many years, the brilliant Peter Dedman. With over five decades in the field of health and well-being, helping to shape the understanding and practice of Chinese medicine here in the West. He's the founder of the Journal of Chinese Medicine, one of the longest running and most influential publications in the field. He's also the co-author of A Manual of Acupuncture, widely regarded as the primary reference text for acupuncture students and practitioners around the world. And the app is on my phone and something I could not live without. Peter's work has also deeply explored the Chinese tradition of Yang Shen, or nourishing life, bringing ancient principles of longevity, emotional balance, and self-cultivation into modern practice. Peter, it is an absolute joy to have you here with us for this episode of Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michelle. Glad to be here.
We are talking today about the causes of disease and specifically our internal emotions. But just before we delve into that, tell me a little bit about the principles and thinking around causes of disease more holistically from a Chinese medicine perspective, Peter.
It's a subject I'm very passionate about, actually, because when we treat in medicine, it doesn't matter what kind of medicine, understanding why a person has become ill, what has transformed them from a healthy person to a troubled or a sick person, can be just vital in helping them get better. So if, for example, there is a cause of disease that is current, is going on day to day, it might be diet, it might be emotional, it might be lack of movement or overwork, no medicine is really likely to be fully successful unless that changes. So for the practitioner, understanding the cause of disease as far as possible and then reflecting it back to the patient in a non-judgmental way can be a really important part of healing.
So when we talk about external causes, and some of those miscellaneous ones, what are we thinking of?
Yeah, well, if I remember correctly, theory of the causes of disease that all Chinese medicine practitioners study and learn and practice goes back to about the 11th century, and it was codified as external, internal, and miscellaneous. It's really smart, I have to say. So external diseases are all diseases caused by some form of pathogen that enters the body from outside. So it's a very broad category that would include, for example, all infectious diseases, which have historically been the greatest threat to human health and life. Then we come to internal diseases, and this is still fairly unique in medicine. The internal causes are the emotions. The potential for excessive emotion, excessively intense emotion, or emotion that endures too long to actually reverberate back and harm our physical and mental health and well-being. And then the miscellaneous causes is a kind of bunch of really important ones. It includes diet, for example. It includes care of the body, for example, too much exercise, not enough exercise, and so on.
It's such an incredible medicine, isn't it, for the depth of awareness they put into those considerations of what causes harm, what causes imbalance and disharmony.
Exactly, yeah.
And so from a Chinese medicine perspective, Peter, how do emotions influence our physical health? What's the thinking and what are the principles that govern the medicine in that regard?
Okay, well, I mean, it's pretty conventional, I think is accurate to say that Western medical philosophy dating from Descartes divided the human being into the body and the mind as two separate entities. It's never like that in Chinese medicine. We've got this really valuable phrase or term, body-mind, meaning that essentially body and mind are one. The body affects the mind and the emotions, the mind and the emotions affect the body, and really in many ways, they're the same thing. And interestingly, this is where the study of the emotions is coming around to in modern psychology and actually in modern medicine. The idea from, I forget his first name, Damasio, that emotions actually start in the body. They're physical reactions that are then interpreted through the brain as emotional feelings.
That's really interesting. Let's look at what happens in the body when emotions are suppressed over time, just after this short break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond. And so what happens physiologically when emotions are suppressed or unprocessed over time?
So most people have heard the term the middle way, a Chinese philosophical term that applies to many different aspects of life. And it really helps when we try and understand the effects of emotions on the body. First of all, emotions are natural, spontaneous responses to life and to life events. All human beings, and probably a lot of, and obviously a lot of animals, have emotions of certain kinds. human beings certainly do. And it's right and proper that we feel things and that emotions are experienced and flow naturally. The problem comes at the two ends of the spectrum. So I've mentioned that there's this very powerful observation that any emotion that's too intense or lasts too long can have a whole host of damaging effects on the body-mind. And this is borne out really increasingly by a lot of medical research into the emotion, affecting emotions on the body. On the other hand, repressing, suppressing emotions, not allowing them to flow appropriately, is also understood both in Chinese medicine and in modern medicine to be a cause of disease. It's certainly implicated in disorders such as headache, heart disease, cancer, and so on. And from the Chinese perspective, all repression of emotions, whatever the emotion is, gives rise to what we call stagnation of qi, stuckness, the opposite of free flow. And that stuckness in the body then reverberates through to pretty much any region of the body. It can affect the head, it can affect the internal organs. In women, it can affect the menstrual cycle. Really, pretty much every part of the body can be affected.
Which is incredible, isn't it? And as you say, it goes back to that real core principle of the body and mind being connected. And in regards to the processing or the holding of emotion, and especially when people are carrying it over long periods of time, directly relate to specific organs, don't they?
Well, they do. But remember, the specific organs in Chinese medicine don't necessarily correspond to the physical organs in Western medicine. So it can be a little bit difficult unless you understand what is meant in Chinese medicine by the organ. So, for example, the emotion that's been most studied recently, well, recently over the last two or three decades, is anger and its effects on the body.
Yeah.
So in terms of research, it's very clear anger is a significant contributor to stroke, to high blood pressure, to cardiac disease, to lung impairment, and to weakness of the immune system. In Chinese medicine, it relates to the liver. And one needs to understand a little bit of Chinese medicine theory to see how those two correspond. If you take stroke, for example, it's said of anger, in going back to the Yellow Emperor's classic written just well over about 2,000 years ago, that anger makes the qi, the energy in the blood, rush up to the head, which is a fairly accurate descriptor of stroke. And then other emotions affect the organs in different ways. Excessive grief is said to injure the lungs, and that's based on the observation that when we grieve, the body slumps, the chest slumps, we don't breathe properly, and over time, the lungs are injured, and so on through the different organs.
Yeah, amazing. It's such a beautiful principle in that way, isn't it? That you have this corresponding relationship, but as you say, understanding the kind of the medicine science around those organs is absolutely key, so people aren't sort of equating them in the same way or functions as we would with Western medicine. But I think what is beautiful about understanding a little bit about that, and even just understanding that relationship with, you know, kind of anger in the liver and grief in the lungs and fear in the kidneys, etc., it just helps people, I think, visualize that mind-body connection much easier, doesn't it? And see that actually how their emotions can cause that disturbance or imbalance if they're not processed properly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And it's interesting you said one of the biggest areas of study had been around anger, because actually we're in a society where we're often talking about leading with kindness. And that kind of encourages people sometimes to suppress anger or to think of anger as something negative and destructive and something they must detach from. And although we're not talking about leading with anger or not being kind, we're talking about the healthy process of emotions and allowing those emotions to be more of the traffic light system they are.
Yeah, I mean, anger's an interesting one. So I think, as well as cultural influences like little girls shouldn't get angry, is very much influenced by family behavior. Some families don't do anger at all. They don't permit anger. They don't permit their children to get angry. Some families do anger all the time. So you have two extremes. One harm through excessive expression of anger and one harm through repression of anger. So the middle way, again, is a term that I really like, is the word assertiveness. And it's something that I talk about quite a lot in Qigong, particularly when we do certain styles of Qigong. Some of the animal forms, like the tiger, I very much think of it as developing assertiveness, which is kind of internal power, and it's power to as opposed to power over. And it's potentially using the powerful force of moderated anger to act effectively in the world.
To kind of use it as a fuel, use it as a tool. I like that. Really lovely. And I think, you know, you're right. Often people will kind of pivot with their emotions at one extreme at the other, but it's that healthy balance and expression of it. What do you see in clinic, Peter, when you're teaching and practicing?
There's a certain amount of truth at the moment. So if you're not angry and if you're not anxious and you're not afraid, you're not paying attention. There's, you know, on every front, there's an awful lot going on, which particularly, I think, affects the mental health of children and young adults. You know, they've been born into a very worrying world when we look at, particularly we look at environmental threats. So what do I see? Well, I think anger, frustration, anxiety very much, fearfulness, and I think anxiety is really important. I'd like to actually slightly move from Chinese medicine to a more physiological view, which is looks at the autonomic nervous system. And the autonomic nervous system is, from a Chinese perspective, we could say it has a yang branch and a yin branch. The yang branch is the sympathetic nervous system, sometimes called the fight or flight response, which is triggered by threat, by danger, by fearfulness, and also by choice. I mean, if we go and see a scary movie or go bungee jumping or do something dangerous, that can trigger the sympathetic nervous system. And it triggers a whole host of physiological responses, which are mostly self-preservation ones. It enables us to respond better in acute danger. The problem is that short-term, it's appropriate, part of our evolutionary system, and those physiological changes can help us. However, if it gets locked in, it can start to cause real harm in the body. For example, excessive sympathetic activation causes inflammation in cells. And we now know that cell inflammation is probably the primary cause of the wide range of chronic non-infectious diseases. I think a lot of the patients that we encounter have varying degrees of excessive sympathetic activation. Now, the opposite, the yin branch, the parasympathetic one, sometimes called the rest and digest. We can expand that and say that it's the healing state, it's the relaxing state, it's the calm, peaceful state, it's the trusting, warm, affectionate state of being. This counters the excessive effects of sympathetic activation. So if you get cell inflammation from excessive sympathetic activation, that cell inflammation is cooled when we move into parasympathetic mode. Now, I think many patients, to varying degrees, are stuck in sympathetic mode, and to some degree they can never relax. Even when, you know, they're nominally relaxing, watching television, even resting and sleeping, they're not deeply, deeply relaxing. So they're not sufficiently entering parasympathetic state. And up to a point, whatever the disease, whatever the problem, we as therapists, and I can say that broadly, acupuncturists, herbalists, psychotherapists, good doctors, any empathetic human helping treating another, can guide them into a more relaxed release of stress parasympathetic state by the encounter, by how we are, how we talk to them, how we listen to them, the empathy we offer. And this is a great gift. So I would say probably your question is a long-winded answer to your question, what do we encounter a lot in the clinic? I would say it's this excessive sympathetic activation, which manifests as anger. It can manifest as fear, chronic fear, anxiety. And just one final point on that. If we live in a state of constant anxiety, or fearfulness, which may be due to, it may be valid. We may be in frightening or anxiety-inducing situations in the family, at work, financial, political, social, or it can be just a way of dealing with the world that we've picked up somewhere, perhaps from our early family. When these emotions become really settled in, often we're not aware of them anymore. They become just the background noise that seems normal. There's a lovely Chinese saying, the last creature to discover water is the fish. We can't see the ocean that we swim in. So if we move on to how we help people deal with their emotional life, I'd say the first step, or one of the first steps, is becoming aware. Becoming aware, more aware of what we're actually feeling some of the time or a lot of the time. And that's the beginning stage of learning to handle emotions and learning to manage them better. And there's great tools and techniques to help us do so. But I think first, we have to become more aware of them, and we have to understand, we have to be educated that this is a really important area to take care of for our health and well-being.
That's absolutely beautiful. And I think you're so right, Peter. It's that awareness has to come first. And that's a great kind of message to us all, isn't it? Is to sometimes slow down enough to allow ourselves to become aware and listen in and see and feel and all of those sort of beautiful sensory communication tools. Again, just blows my mind that this sort of stuff was written about so long ago. And, you know, there was such a wisdom there. Are you excited by modern medicine and where we are in regards to research and studies now emerging that evidence the importance of these internal causes of disease, and also evidence our understanding now of how they manifest physiologically? What else do you want to see happening?
When I first studied Chinese medicine and came across these causes of disease, I was a bit young enough and not terribly aware, I suppose. And, you know, when I heard the emotions were a cause of disease, I went, oh, yeah, okay, all right, I suppose so, I get it. I didn't really understand, I didn't really absorb it. But about 15 or 18 years ago, I started researching and teaching this Chinese tradition called Yangsheng, which is about, translates as the nourishment of life. A 2,500-year wisdom, body of wisdom of how to manage this human organism that we're each currently inhabiting. And I started doing research, and that's when I discovered there was quite a lot of modern research in the emotion on the emotions, and that helped me understand the Chinese tradition. It reflected back. The Chinese wisdom was there all the time, but when I first studied it, I wasn't smart enough to really fully understand it. So I think the two are really important, both really important. And another thing just there is I came from a very kind of alternative background with a lot of suspicion of Western medicine, modern medicine, and there are many very powerful and important criticisms we can and should make about Western medical thinking. But it is contributed to by hundreds of thousands of the smartest people on the planet. And so I'm actually quite a fan of Western medicine as well as traditional medicine. But I think that traditional Chinese medicine has something that modern medicine doesn't, and that's wisdom.
Yeah.
And that includes both highfalutin philosophical wisdom, but day-to-day wisdom about daily life, which is just embodied in the centuries and millennia of human experience, which has been discounted in modern medicine. You know, it's been regarded as whatever to terms, old wives' tales or ignorance, whereas in the Chinese tradition, this wisdom about daily life was held, passed on, refined century after century by some of the greatest minds of Chinese medicine. And it's a great resource and one that is missing in Western medicine and really is needed to complement it.
Yeah. And I think that's so true, isn't it? And for me personally, I get quite excited about the point of where we're at, only because I think there is this kind of undoubted wisdom that has stood the test of time and has evidenced itself, as you say, over sort of millennia. And now we're at a point where we can use modern technology to kind of confirm and sort of, reassure that sort of thinking, which has been incredible, hasn't it? And I think, as you say, it's the merger of the two together that kind of work really well, respecting that kind of wisdom and the broader medicine, because it's not just about the physiological treating of the person, is it? It's about helping them live in harmony with themselves, the environment around them and one another, whilst also kind of being able to really personalize and sort of get very specific in the way we support an individual where they are right now.
Exactly. So been big changes in modern medicine in relation particularly to behavior and lifestyle. So I'll give you an example. When I was involved in the natural foods movement in the early 70s, a shop in London was prosecuted for selling a booklet that suggested that diet could be significantly related to the development of cancer.
Wow.
And now, if you look on the World Health Organization cancer website, it lists diet as, I can't remember, the number one or number two contributory causes of cancer. Everybody now, whatever their actual behavior is, understands that diet plays an important role in health. Even 50 years ago, that was definitely not the case. You know, the only thing that they were interested in dietary medicine really was a deficiency, like vitamin deficiencies and so on, or a deficiency of essential nutrients. That was it. As long as you got enough protein, carbohydrate, vitamins and minerals, you were fine. There was nothing more to be said about it. So it's come a long way. However, open any newspaper, any magazine, watch telly, and people constantly fighting over what constitutes a healthy diet. So we're now besieged by 1,000 voices advising us about, you know, coming from different places, you know, no carbohydrate, no meat, no whatever. We all know, we're familiar with them. So then if we look to Chinese medicine or the Chinese health tradition, we've got, it's like encountering a grown-up in the room. You know, the wise person we turn to that's actually just been looking at this for 2,500 years and figuring out some of the basic principles of a healthy diet that include not only what we eat, which is, as I say, much discussed, but how we eat, eating habits, that's still not really discussed. Time of eating, quantity of eating, state of mind when eating, these are all really important in the Chinese tradition. We find the same thing with exercise. There was a Hungarian Jewish refugee who did the first modern study of exercise. He looked at when double-decker buses in Britain had bus conductors and drivers, he compared the health status of the two, because drivers sat all day and bus conductors ran up and downstairs, and he found significantly more heart disease in bus drivers. And when it was published in the newspaper, the headline was "The Man Who Invented Exercise," and he received massive opposition from the scientific world, who didn't like to believe what he said. I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, traditional medicine, not just Chinese, going back to Hippocrates in Greek medicine or Maimonides or Ibn Sina in Arabic medicine, they all understood these things. However, although there's been great progress, a bit of confused progress, as I say, about understanding diet and exercise and so on, there is still not that much understanding of the effect of the emotions. And this is an area still where Chinese medicine absolutely leads the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that comes back full circle, doesn't it, to your opening section on the mind-body connection in that Western medicine has still very much treated the physiological body and separated that from the mind and emotions.
Exactly.
In quite a reductionist approach, hasn't it? You know, very specialist-focused areas rather than also thinking about the overarching harmony of us as a whole and us within our environment. In connection with one another. And I think that's where this becomes so important. Not just understanding it, but knowing what to do with it. Let's explore that in just a moment after this short break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science with me, Michelle Hammond. So Peter, picking up from that, what can people start to do in a practical sense to better support their emotional well-being?
So it would be very depressing if we talked about the negative effects of excessive indulgence in a particular emotion or emotions and repression without pointing to the way forward. So tools at various levels. I think that given that stress, excessive sympathetic activation, anxiety, worry, fear are very predominant nowadays, there are some simple tools that can help. So one of them is breathing. Slow, deep breathing has been always taught in the Chinese self-cultivation tradition, going back again 2,500 years. But much more recently, it's been researched, and it's one of the quickest ways of shifting our autonomic nervous system out of the fight or flight state into the rest, relax, repair, healing state. And it can be easily learned. It's slow, deep, diaphragmatic breathing. So that's diaphragmatic breathing is the opposite of breathing into the chest. Chest breathing. So if you ask an untrained person to breathe deeply, they'll feel their chest. That's not actually that helpful. In fact, it can increase feelings of stress. The idea is actually to kind of try and bypass the chest and take the breath down as low as we can. And what the effect of that is to maximize the downward movement of the diaphragm, which then triggers a whole host of beneficial physiological effects. So I think learning and practicing diaphragmatic breathing, or sometimes called lower abdominal breathing, is probably the single most helpful tool. But one needs to learn. I mean, you can, you know, there's probably 10,000 YouTube videos teaching. It's not difficult to access. The second thing that I am a big fan of, but requires a bit more commitment, the breathing requires commitment because it has to be practiced. It's no good waiting till you're in a really stressful situation and going, what was that thing I'm supposed to do with my breath? No, you have to train yourself. You have to build up the skill so that that more relaxed state becomes more of a default state, one that you can access much more quickly in times of emotional difficulty or stress. The second, which also requires dedicated practice, but nobody said this should be easy. In fact, I think learning to manage the emotions is probably the hardest of all lifestyle changes, by far, is mindful movement. So mindful movement is a broad category that includes things like yoga, includes my practice, Qigong, Tai Chi, Pilates, and more. And it combines the benefits of physical movement, often slow physical movement combined with slow, deep breathing, with the key element of mental presence, mental absorption. It's the opposite of running on a treadmill in a gym and watching television. It's we try to be fully present in the breath, in the body, in the movement, maybe what's, if we're outside, you know, the breeze, the bird sounds, whatever it is. This introduces the beneficial element of meditation. So meditation fundamentally is, I mean, it's a deep subject, but fundamentally it's the art of training us to be more present in the very moment we are in. And we know from research that it significantly changes certain structures in the brain. And those structures in the brain are responsible for emotional control, self-control. And what happens if you practice enough, when we encounter a triggering event that where our normal response would be hurt, anger, or jealousy, or fear, or whatever it is, we gain a moment of space, where we have choice. We have a moment of choice to indulge, to throw ourselves into that emotion, to shout our head off, to whatever, or choose a different way of dealing with that. So mindful movement or sitting meditation, which is probably more difficult for many people to just sit and try and be present, is another really vital tool. And finally, it's not a factor in traditional Chinese medicine. It's the great gift of modern psychology for many of us. At some point in our lives, we need to do a course of therapy to help us see what's going on and uncover the deeper layers that can be very hard to see just on our own.
They're such practical sort of guide tools, aren't they, for people? And as you say, they're simple to learn and understand, but take practice. Thank you, Peter, for sharing those. And obviously, as a psychotherapist myself, I'm a massive advocate for talking. And I always often wonder how people get through their day-to-day life without having a therapist to offload to. Someone who doesn't have that emotional attachment, or there's no consequence in the relationship for what you share, what you bring up, and has that kind of autonomy within that space as well, I think is invaluable.
Indeed.
Peter, it is an absolute pleasure to speak with you, honestly. Thank you so much. I feel like I could curl up on the sofa with a cup of tea and just listen to you all day. You know, your wisdom, your experience, the depth of experience I know goes back 5 decades, and it's absolutely palpable. I'd love to spend more time. I think we'll definitely have to get you back on the show. But thank you for coming and joining me, and for sharing a little bit of your wisdom with us to help us look at ways we can make improvements to our emotions and better support our day-to-day life.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Michelle.
So as we come to the end of today's conversation, what really stays with me is just how deeply this ancient understanding still speaks to the way we live today. Understanding that our emotions aren't something separate from our health, they're an intrinsic part of it. Not something to push aside, override, or manage at the surface, but something to listen to understand, and to move with. Because as Peter so beautifully shared, it's not emotion itself that causes harm. Emotion is natural, it's human and intelligent. It's when it becomes too intense, too prolonged, or held without expression that it begins to shift the internal landscape of our bodies. And what I find so fascinating is that whether we're looking through the lens of Chinese medicine or modern science, we're now hearing the same message, just maybe using different language. Chinese medicine speaks of stagnation, stuckness, disruption of flow, where modern science speaks of chronic stress, nervous system dysregulation, and inflammation at a cellular level. Different words, but same underlying truth. And perhaps that's where this conversation becomes really important, because many of us are living in that low-level, constant state of activation, aren't we? We're not always aware of it, because as Peter said so perfectly, the last creature to discover water is the fish. We become so used to how we feel that it starts to feel normal. That background anxiety, that low-level tension, the constant busyness. And yet beneath that, the body is working really hard to keep up. So maybe the invitation from today's episode isn't to analyze everything or to do more or to fix anything or everything overnight, but simply to begin, as Peter said, with awareness. To pause, just occasionally, and ask, what am I actually feeling right now? And what am I doing with that feeling? Am I pushing it down? Am I holding on to it? Or am I allowing it to move? Because emotions aren't the problem. They're simply a signal. They're the guidance system, the body's way of communicating with us. And when we start to listen, rather than suppress, we begin to create movement again. And it's that movement that brings real change. And as we heard today, that doesn't have to be complicated. It can start with something as simple as the breath. Slowing things down, dropping the breath deeper into the body, or creating just a little more space in the system. Or bringing more presence into how you move, how you live, how you experience this moment. Or when needed, reaching out and speaking to someone so that you're not holding internally what doesn't have to stay there alone. Because ultimately, this is not about controlling the emotion. It's about developing a healthier relationship with it. And maybe that starts by simply noticing. So take a moment in your day to check in before you carry on. That slower breath, that little more awareness, that little more honesty with yourself maybe. Because as we know, it is not the big changes that shape our health. It's the small things done consistently. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science on UK Health Radio. And a huge thank you to Peter Dedman for sharing his wisdom and perspective with us today. If you want to learn more about Peter, you can do so by jumping over to his website at peterdedman.com. If this conversation resonated with you, I would love for you to share it with someone you think might need it too. And help us grow our listening community so together we can bring these insights into more lives in ways that truly make a difference. Remember, you can join me here every week on UK Health Radio for Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science. To access expert-led masterclasses, professional training and accredited courses, head on over to tpot.org.uk. That's tpot.org.uk. Or you can visit michellehammond.co.uk for personalised health and wellbeing support. I'm Michelle Hammond, and until next time, take care of yourself in all the ways that matter most to you.